I'm now going back to the questions on the period I was with General Bell and the camps, training camps of that period. What were my reactions and later on to the Plattsburgh experiment? I think Plattsburgh had two or three sides to it. One was the political significance, when the president, as it were, was opposed to all preparations in order to preserve a neutral front, and General Woods and General Theodore Roosevelt's actions in order to stir up preparations. Of course, Plattsburgh was the answer to this. Of its kind, it was inspirational and had a great effect on the men that were in it. Affected all their later lives, as a matter of fact. It did a wonderful job in a very brief time. It was all we had to reach for, and under the circumstances, a very, very fine job was done. As to its effects, it rose up later to make things very difficult for me in the preparations for World War II. It was the best we could do for World War I under the circumstances, with the president's attitude, with no money from Congress, with the general staff cut down to 16, I believe. That was the pressure of the chairman of the military committee, was to get everybody that had any experience in Washington out of Washington and get rid of the staff. We'd run an army without any staff, of course. The fact that you had 2,000 or 3,000 on the same staff later on, there's no proof that you should have had more than 16 at that time. These are terrible things that were done because of political twists, and I suppose they always will be done. So I had quite a difficult time at the start of World War II because I was determined that we would train our officers thoroughly. We had presumably we were going to have time to do it, and I intended to do it. Of course, we started off with a great shortage until the first reserve officers had had about a year's experience. They were not successful, really, as teachers of an intense course of training. They didn't know assuredly enough themselves. Fine men and all, but not enough for that. So it is quite a period before we had practically anybody to conduct this training, because the regular army was now scattered so thinly that people weren't available. I was opposed to the inception of the draft as early as it went into effect, violently in favor of it, but I wanted the thing to be approached in a little better ordered way. I was told that politically it was essential to go right ahead with it at top speed, that otherwise I would lose it. Well, the trouble with that was we didn't have the instructors, and I remember finding the now head of the Federal Reserve Board, one time president of the Stock Exchange, and then president of the Stock Exchange, who had been drafted in one of these earliest drafts, and I found him being instructed by a corporal who had only been a corporal a month and who had been in the Army 13 years and never been even made the grade of corporal. Well, of course, his instruction was an absurdity so far as the quality of the man he was trying to instruct. And that was our trouble all around. Now, the pressure was terrific to increase the size of the training camps, the early training camps, particularly because what we'd done in the First World War and the fact that Australia was doing it again at the present time. The whole staff combined were violently opposed to this because we didn't have the instructor materiel and we wanted to make a much slower start and work up to it. And the others maintained that there was not time for that, and public opinion demanded it. And I had a very difficult fight. And when Mr. Stimson became Secretary of War, before he came to his first office, I went to Long Island to see him, and that was the first thing he talked to me about. And he was interrupted twice during the talk by telephone messages from previous Plattsburgh camp men, Grenville Clark was being one of the leaders, who wanted him to change things instantly the minute he got into position as Secretary of War. When he came down to Washington, he was still of that temper, and the new Undersecretary of War was a Plattsburgh graduate, and altogether was now a judge and has since been died in an airplane crash. The whole setup then was to restore the Plattsburgh mood immediately and in quantity. Everybody in the staff was opposed to it because we knew perfectly well we didn't have the people to conduct the training. And I was determined that we were going to do this thoroughly. And it would have to be thoroughly for the kind of war we were going to fight. We had to turn out trained divisions that could fight their first battle, not a learning battle, but a battle to the death, which they later did with a great triumph, the time of Patton's and the First Army's moves in northern France and the army that moved up about May 14th in Italy with these new divisions, the first of the new divisions to get in the war. I'll talk about them more later on because it's something that's been overlooked, and I think it's a very wonderful exhibition. So I had a very difficult time. Here was the new Secretary of War, a man I greatly respected, who had asked me to go with him to the Philippines in order to make me a Brigadier General of Philippine Scouts and or Constabulary or some of that sort, and I declined to go. I wanted to get away from staff duty. And I had the greatest respect for him, and yet he was obsessed with this. He was a Plattsburgh man. There wasn't any question about the great benefit of the camps at the time of the First World War, but this is a totally different situation, and I was determined that we were not going to get into that. And this was going to be a thoroughly done thing, and we succeeded, but we had to go very slowly. I had difficulties with my own staff where I tried to give a little in order that the thread wouldn't break. They didn't want to give a darned inch. And I would have to make the slight concession, as I say, in order to keep the thread from breaking, but they were violently opposed to it. There wasn't anybody on the staff in favor of this. And they were traveling all over the country because we'd gotten into a minor mobilization right away when we tried to bring five divisions of the Army, the only existing divisions, together. And they varied from about 60% complete, one, down to about 10% complete. They were just little sketchy things scattered all over the country. You'd find one company belonging to a division out in Seattle or thereabouts, and the other companies here in the east, and altogether it was almost a ridiculous setup for an army. That's what I had to dig it out of to get ready to organize this army and for the Second World War. So I was determined not to be pushed into this, and it was a very difficult thing with both the secretary and the undersecretary, splendid men, both of them, ex-Plattsburgh men and strongly in favor of it, and the ex-Plattsburgh leaders, Grenville Clark and the others, holding up Australia to us as an example. Well, I won't go into what happened to Australia, but we had a very difficult time. Fortunately, I had an absolutely united staff on this. They were all together, and I had very fine men, and we were doing the best we could. It finally got to a showdown, and this is one of the few times that I think there's only one other time I did this, but it looked like it was a lost cause, and I told the secretary that if that was the case, I would resign as chief of staff and he'd get somebody else. And I think I got a little sarcastic and saying, you get a Plattsburgh man and run it to your own satisfaction. Well, he didn't want to have that happen, and I didn't want to have it happen either. And we finally got compromised around and began to get these classes started. Next thing, we didn't have the textbooks. And I've explained once, I think, how I managed to get that done by holding Leavenworth instructors over for a period and putting them into the preparation of, I think it was 52 textbooks, and doing the same with a certain number that I held down at the War College of the ex-instructors when I suppressed the school in its ordinary routine. But one way or another, we were gradually getting this thing out of the kinks. But it was a very difficult time and a very torturous time, and one in which I was treading on very delicate ground. I didn't have the confidence of the president. I don't mean that I'd lacked his entire confidence, but he didn't know me. He had made me on the recommendation of other people, and now with all of this coming up, and they were coming to see him, even one of my, I better not get into names here. a very high government official who was seating the president. And they told me this. He was having a great influence on him. He has a very, very high position in this country. And I think I did a very wise thing, but it was a very difficult thing to do. I made his acquaintance, and I won him over, not by arguing about that at all. I didn't even mention it. But I won his respect. He thought I knew what I was doing. And after that, he was advising the president to follow my advice. And he remained my supporter for many years. All of this was the struggle, which was a back kick on a very fine thing, the Plattsburgh camps. Our great struggle, as I say, was to find instructors. Everybody was on a job, and a tremendous expansion was underway, and that was coming much faster than I wanted it. And as I say, I couldn't slow it down because they told me I would find the Selective Service Act, the Draft Act, as they called it, revoked if I in any way delayed its procedure. The divisions were organized way ahead of the rate I wanted them to be organized. Most all of these things occurred in 1916, and I should have think, and that was when I was having some of my greatest problems, my most instructive problems, and my most difficult problems, and my broadest experience, preliminary to the actual going to France. I have no particular comment on Governor's Island, except for my own experiences there, which I've already described. When it comes to the question of was war with Germany inevitable, I didn't get into that. I was so busy with the army itself and the national defense, you might call, that I didn't cogitate much over the political significance of things, and whatever momentary opinion I had at the time, I couldn't put into words at the present time. But I was so intense on the thing I was doing that I wasn't going off and trying to advise the president and the American public how to handle their international diplomatic troubles. I knew if they went to Europe what they had to have, and I was prepared to try to give that to the best of my ability. These various questions here, 5, 6, and 7, on the neutrality and when we should have first gone to war and all, I won't go into because I didn't have in my own mind a very strong stand in regard to them. I did have a strong stand in regard to Mr. Wilson's neutrality program. Neutrality, yes, that's what he wanted. But to prevent us from making any measures at all to get ready was terrible. And he didn't have any comprehension of what a pathetic, that isn't the real word, it goes way beyond pathetic, situation we were involved in. And only time can cure that. And if you've lost the time, you never can get it back. My only observations in regard to that, which would refer to question 7, is that we could have gone ahead and done these things and still have been neutral. But we've been treated with greater respect. In 1939, 1941, I saw very much reflections of the things of 15 and 16 all over again. In fact, there was, in some ways, very little occurred that didn't seem to me was a repetition. But what disturbed me most of all was to find the Army, the War Department, and the country in the same shape again, in the same shape again. And I was getting rather hardened to coming in when everything had gone to pot, there was nothing to get your hands on, and darned if I didn't find the same thing when I came into the Korean War. There wasn't anything. We had a terrible time getting ourselves together. On the heading World War I, questions 1, and with the sub-questions as to my the first contingent to France and General Pershing on my first appearance and points of interest on the trip over, I've already referred to all that. Question 2, the American landing at San Nazaire. I've covered that. I've answered the question of being in Paris. for the not for the not for the 4th of July parade, but for the Bastille Day parade, I think. I've also described Saint-Nazaire at that time. Question 3, I've pretty largely answered. Question 4. I was starting out to inspect the American battalions that are included in French regiments in the line in that Lunéville sector, and I was leaving at 4 in the morning. The division commander, the French division commander, was very sensitive to having any American interference possible with his control, and he didn't want me to go out. And when he found out I was going out that morning, he had my car stopped at his headquarters, and I had to wait till he came out, and then he told me that le premier American sont tués, the first Americans have been killed. And that was the first notice we had of the deaths of these men and the capture of 14, though that hadn't been yet reported. So we went out, and he went, of course, to the brigade commander's headquarters, and that was a loss of time, which I didn't like, but that was the formality, and they always went through it. And then he went from there to the French regimental commander's headquarters, in which these battalions were scattered, and that was a loss of time. And however, just as we were leaving there, the adjutant of the regiment, a captain, ran after us down the field and said that there'd been a raid. They had proof positive there'd been a raid because the Germans had announced the capture of North Americans north of the Rhine-Marne Canal. So we knew we'd been raided, but at that time they didn't know it. And we went on up and came to the headquarters of the battalion commander, which was in a stone quarry, as I recall, and he didn't know there'd been a raid then. There'd been a heavy artillery bombardment, but he wasn't aware of the fact there'd been a raid. He didn't go forward to me, incidentally. I didn't ask him to, didn't say anything about it. He just didn't go. So I started forward with Jean Hugo, who was my interpreter and liaison officer and a very fine fella, and the French general. I had to go the way he went, but we went up this communication trench that had been splattered with fire all the way up, beautiful target shooting, and then we got into this deep front line trench. In those days the front line trench were very deep, and the principal dugouts were under the front line parapet. Later on that was changed, of course, but the principal line was in rear of this first line. Then it was not only in the first line, but under the parapet of the first line, large dugouts that hold 15, 20 men. And we met a French officer who had been assigned to this battalion, which had just gone in the night before, and the French had left a few officers there to help them. And he told us there had been a raid, and there had been Americans killed. And he thought Americans captured, that he didn't know. The battalion commander was still under the impression that there hadn't been a raid, and we told him to go on back to tell the battalion commander. Then we went forward till we came to a place where the trench was caved in. Now I remember climbing up on top of the trench. Everything was very quiet. No man's land was almost a half mile wide there. And I got up on top, and here down below me, just a little to my right front, was the blasted gap in the wire, which was about 60 yards wide there, the white tape to guide the raiding party right through the wire leading up to the front trench. Well, here was the scene of the raid, no question about it now. We had a hard climb to get up to the part of the trench where this tape came in and where the defenders had been surprised, and we went down into this dugout where there was quite a bit of blood about, where some had been killed and or wounded. And then we came up and found the dead on the ground, and the wounded had gone back. There were quite a few wounded. I say quite a few. It was something like 14 captured, and we'll say 18 wounded, something of that sort. Most of the wounded had been wounded by the artillery bombardment. And I went back with the general, and we met some of the wounded, and he questioned them quite a bit, and then Jean Hugo whispered to me that the general is trying to find out whether the Americans showed fight. So I interrupted him. I said, "General, I understand you're trying to find out whether the Americans showed fight or not. I don't think there's any necessity of questioning that. They've been surprised, and they probably put up a disordered fight, and most of them are trapped in a dugout. But I don't think that's the thing to investigate. I think it'd be very much more to the point if you look into the fact that you forbade the Americans to go beyond the wire in any reconnaissance, and now they're surprised by the assault right through the wire. I think your General Pershing is going to be very much interested in that reaction of a French commander to American troops." This went on. I mention this here because it went on to quite a serious matter later on, as I will explain. The French commander was getting very stiff, and I was getting very anxious to get back, and I went first to the triage, or first line hospital, and there I found these wounded men being treated. But the principal thing I noticed was a large typewriter of the size that'll take a big form, and the principal sergeant had this form in the typewriter and was typing away. When I looked to see what it was, it was what's called the sick and wounded report. And he'd gotten through, I think, one name, maybe two. It was a very lengthy thing, and it might be as carefully done as your description by the doctor of your situation in pneumonia or something of that sort. I could see from the number of wounded he had and the progress he'd made on this thing that it was going to take him about all day long to complete that form. So I said, "What the hell are you going to do if you have a battle with 1,000 casualties? This is absurd." I said, "You just drop that for the present and get to work on these men." So he was very, very uncertain about doing this thing that I was so freely ordering, but I bluffed him out of it. And then I took his typewriter, and there I wrote the report that's on file in regarding the raid. I met right after that, still on the field, a colonel of the Surgeon General's Department over in France making an inspection. And of course, as this is the only place where there were men in the field, he came there, and he was very anxious to come up there to this hospital where the first wounded were in. I told him then the first thing he might report was to change that sick and wounded report so that there's some possibility of getting it out if there were any more than 50 wounded men in a day. That is a ridiculous thing the way it was now, and I'd forbidden the man to finish it until he went about his regular duties. And he did do that. I think he changed it after he got home. It is an absurdity the way it was arranged. It is all very well for an investigation after the war, but it wasn't at all a practical proposition if you really got into a first-class action. To go on with this thing, I might as well finish it up while I'm at it. When I got back to headquarters, I wanted to go and see the corps commander. And the idea of a captain, I don't think I was yet a major. Going to see the corps commander was unheard of, but I was representing the division commander, who was 100 more kilometers away. So my rank didn't cut any figure with me, as far as I could see. My job was to represent him and his interests, and his interests were very heavily involved here. This is the first American action, and we had been surprised, and prisoners had been taken, and the Germans were advertising it, and we had our first dead, and we had our collection of wounded. So I had written my first report of the affair on the typewriter of the sergeant I displaced in the getting the sick and wounded report out. And now I wanted to do another one for General Pershing, General Seibert, in explaining the situation where they were forbidden from going beyond the wire in any reconnaissance. And then were surprised through the wire with this blast from a Bangalore torpedo and the rush of the men. The division commander sent for me and asked me, said he understood I was going to see the corps commander, and he wanted to know what I was going there for, and I told him exactly. Well, he said he would prefer that I would restrain myself and not do that. He said, you're a very young officer, and this is a very serious matter. I said, that's the reason I'm going there, General. It is a very serious matter, and I'm representing the division commander. And I've got to consider him and his rank and his position and the fact that this is the first unit and the first engagement. And just then, the Corps Chief of Staff, I think, arrived. He was very much exercised when he found what I was going to do. And he begged me not to embarrass the Corps Commander at this particular moment. And I said, I'm going to report it to General Seibert, and he'll report it, of course, to General Pershing. Meanwhile, a message had come in from General Pershing's headquarters wanting to report direct from me, because they were still in the business of trying to command minor units. And I explained that I would have to go ahead and report to General Seibert, and I was going to say this, because I said it's a very, very serious matter, and I don't have to be a general to see that. And I said, I wish you'd tell your corps commander so that he can interest himself in it right away, because the order still stands. And General Pershing, I know, would want to know about it right away, and General Seibert must know about it right away. And we had quite a scene there. I reported this to General Seibert, and I reported it to General Pershing. And then they arranged the funeral of these three men, and I've always been sorry since that they didn't allow them to remain buried right there, because that is very historic. And this division commander that I've been arguing with, and he'd been so strict with me, made a very beautiful talk at their grave, which is in this little town, I think of Bazancourt. And it was in the rain, mud. The town was just a crossroad in a manure pile. That's about what it amounted to, and a haystack or two around. And the French sent up a battalion of infantry, a troop of cavalry. I don't think they had their horses, though. Not certainly at the funeral. Some artillery, some engineers, some signal corps. They had every unit of this corps, as I recall, present, and they made it quite a significant occasion. And the first Americans were born there. And I took the division commander into a dugout with Jean Hugo and had him repeat his remarks at the grave. And Juan Hugo, write them down. And they are on record in the War Department now. And when I was questioned the other day from France as to what would be the proper inscription on a monument they were putting up there, I suggested the best thing they could do was this paragraph out of this speech, and I think they adopted that. It is their own division commander's speech. This division commander was transferred to a mission to Greece immediately, and he disappeared from the scene at that time. I was very much gratified when I went to a church service in Paris. I've forgotten for what. It was a military significance. And a number of French commanders were there to walk with me to the church. This was when I was Secretary of State. And this particular general had come up from the provinces to attend the service and came up and spoke to me and was very cordial and very very generous in his comments. When I came over later to attend the United Nations, he communicated with me again. He's since died. I had another thing that taught me quite a lesson there. We had no transportation, and the French had to loan us the trucks, or lorries, as the British called them. I don't know what the French called them, I've forgotten that. But they loaned us the trucks, and we didn't have enough. And the 1st Battalion hadn't had enough of their battalion headquarters. And in this battalion that was coming up next was also included the regimental headquarters. And it is going to require some delicate shuffling to be able to haul them up. So I had to get into a discussion with the French staff about these loading of these trucks, what we should put in them, and they would come up with this relief and the additional units of the headquarters, and they would go back with the troops that had their experience, first experience in the trenches. Well, we agreed in something in principle, en principe, and there I learned my lesson, which served me well in after dealings, particularly with the French units in the Meuse-Argonne battle and other places. En principe, in my mind, applied to one thing only. To the French, it applied to everything. The result was that all the machine guns units were grounded and unloaded from the and not loaded on the trucks, and didn't get off to Gondricourt, and were left up there without any transportation. We were short in the first place. And this thing occurred, and I discovered it all hinged on the translation of the full meaning of en principe. So after that, whenever a Frenchman brought up something and would summarize by saying, now, en principe so-and-so, I'd stop him right there. I'd say, now, you write that out. You write out exactly what you mean. And they all got to laughing at me later on when I had several French corps, three or four French corps in the First Army, and they'd send back the chief of staff or somebody to make arrangements. And he'd come to the usual expression, now, en principe, I'd say, now, wait a minute. Take a pencil and write out exactly what you're talking about. So I never had any more accidents of that sort, and it's a very valuable lesson. It also brought up another thing, which shows how difficult it is for armies of different nations to work with full harmony, though it's their best effort to do so. And that even was the occasion with the British, when we thought we spoke the same tongue, but we discovered afterwards that the meaning we gave a word was not at all the same in many instances, and we had to be very careful in what we said. The only place I ever got this right was over in China, because when the communists met with the nationalists and I sat in as the middle party, they used my translation of my interpreter as the guiding rein in this thing, and the thing was translated according to that. It was safer to translate the English to Chinese together, those two, than it was to use either one of the communists or the nationalists' Chinese record of what was said. And they always wanted my English one, in order that together they might translate that. So the significance of each term would be fully understood. I started, refer back to something that had occurred of that nature, and I think it was connection with the British. But my memory's played me false, and I've forgotten it already. General Seibert was relieved, and General Bullard set up to take command. In your question 5, or your statement 5, you say Colonel Fuquay was chief of staff. He was not chief of staff. He didn't become chief of staff until practically the end of the Meuse-Argonne battle. He'd been under me before that in the G3 section of the staff, looking after the troop movements and things of that sort. We had a very interesting thing took place in my career here. I learned afterwards that General Bullard, when he came to the division, had rather been tipped off. I'd met him before, and he'd been temporarily in the command of a brigade before. No, he'd been in the command of a brigade before, which I was dealing with when I was acting chief of staff. And he complimented me on the way I was doing it, I remember. So when he came up from wherever he was to become the new chief of commander of the division, as I learned much later, after the war, as a matter, almost the end of the war, as a matter of fact, that the intention was to make me chief of staff. Camel King, a very dear friend of mine, was the adjutant who had been temporarily at Chaumont as with the general staff. And he'd come up there and gone back to his original post as adjutant of the 1st Division. When General Bullard came to the division, we were infuriated by the misunderstanding of our situation, which culminated with the relief of General Seibert. At GHQ, these fellows at GHQ were almost all my close friends and associates at Leavenworth. Most of them had been student officers under me at Leavenworth. And they were some of my dear friends. But we were wholly out of sympathy with each other, and I felt that they didn't understand what they were doing at all. They'd become very severe, and they didn't know what they were being severe about. I would explain it best that way. And General Pershing was severe, so they modeled their attitude on him. I was so outraged with this that I talked a great deal, and I made a great mistake, which helped. I learned the lesson then that I never forgot afterwards. But when General Bullard came to the division, all of us were airing our views and being very vitriolic, because it was very difficult. What are you trying to do? It's almost impossible. And we were bitter. Well, what I did was I demonstrated to General Bullard I had no business being made chief of staff in that state of mind. And he didn't make me chief of staff. He made Camel King chief of staff, who was a much more moderate person and didn't get head up to the extent I did. I learned my lesson. Nobody ever told me that, but I could see perfectly well what it was. And I agreed with it thoroughly. And I never made the mistake, I don't think, again. And I've often commented on how in the world I ever kept my temper through all the vicissitudes that I had to go through, political and otherwise. And this was the lesson that I got right there, and I never forgot it. I think I delayed myself a great deal. I think if I'd been chief of staff of the division, I would have very quickly been made a brigadier general. Matter of fact, I wasn't recommended for a brigadier general till in the Meuse-Argonne battle. And while it was approved by the Secretary of War, General March never sent it to the Senate for confirmation. You mentioned Seyspray in this description of on 5, and that was quite a difficult town because it was down the hollow and very difficult to defend. We had to build up the trenches and with weaving these sticks together in order to hold up the dirt wall to screen us from the view from Mont Sec, on which now is a very beautiful monument and observation station all over the battlefield, and of which I am somewhat in charge as chairman of the Battle Monuments Commission. I don't care to make any comments about General Seibert and General Bullard. The best I can say about this section is we took over a very large section because our division was about twice the size of a French division. And the whole sector was under observation. It was dominated by these heights on the other side, and particularly by Mont Sec. I didn't see much of the French troops that were relieved as they went out very quickly. They were there for a rest and were very much opposed to our stirring up the sector and making it active in a battle way. We were very proud of it, we were very foolish. Though, as a matter of fact, I suppose the new troops, it was rather important that they get that much experience to make them battle worthy. The French morale at that time was all right. It had suffered, of course, by the Verdun fighting and the terrible losses they had there, and by the reversal on the Somme. It had suffered very much from that. But the great disaster was impending, which came on March 21st, 1918, shortly, just as we were moving from that sector. I think I was actually called Z3 at this time. We made up the proposal for how the staff should be formed, and I don't remember whether we proposed G3 or I think that was proposed on Chaumont. Incidentally, that 1, 2, and 3 that you had the division then, I organized, without knowing anything about this thing, in the Philippines with this force that I was dropped into a sort of a peculiar command of. I didn't have a G2 much. I had a man that did something like that, but I had specifically a G1 and specifically a G3, though I didn't call them that. And it worked like a machine. They were very excellent officers. I know the main thing that I used to insist upon after we got through the tactical deployments was to see that the troops went into bivouac without halting, that they shouldn't be waiting on the road to find out where they're going to camp. That all should be decided ahead of them, and they should come up and be shown where to wheel into line and stack arms and bivouac, which this impromptu staff I designed, I organized accidentally, you might say, always did. Debonnet is the correct name for General Debonnet, and I knew him very well because his son was with the French division that had the same headquarters we did, and he and I became very close together. He had one arm shot off, and I knew his father for that reason. He commanded the 1st French Army, and I thought he was a very fine man. And I met him again when we all moved to the west to fill in where he was given the job of command, where the British 5th Army was destroyed and the Germans almost broke through. That was the end. The point of that thing was at Montdidier. So I saw General Debonnet very often, and he was always very nice to me. So far as I could tell, I thought he was a very fine Army commander. At least about the Americans, he knew something about them. And whether he admired them or not, he knew about them and could act very intelligently in his handling of them. That came out later when we were in the middle of a counterattack and the end of the German great action. The recommendation went through that I'd be promoted. I'd already been advanced on Christmas Day to lieutenant colonel. But when the recommendation came up that I'd be made a colonel, they had already gotten out a rule at GHQ at Washington that you couldn't promote these men on staff duty until they'd served a certain line. Of course, that was made up for the staffs in the United States and not at all for the staffs over there in Europe. And there weren't very many over there. And we were mixed up in the fighting right and left, as you could tell from my descriptions, and yet we were barred from promotion. I came into circumstances somewhat similar to that in the next World War, and I knew perfectly well what lines of action to try to take in order to correct it. I was finding very rapid promotion over here in the new divisions being assembled and the big training camps, and over in France. Over in Africa, they were only promoting the men that had been very special in action or wounded. This restriction on my promotion continued until the time of the Meuse-Argonne battle. Almost a half a year later. The speech in 7 that you referred to was when I was first sent into the region when the 1st Division was coming up, and I was ordered to provide for the arrangements for the reception of 4 divisions that were coming later. One was the 2nd Division, one was the 42nd Division. I've forgotten the other two. But they were all to be scattered around that region. I came into Neufchâteau. I was the first American officer to come there. Neufchâteau was probably identified better by being southwest, a short distance from Doremy, John Dark's home. Well, anyway, when I came into town, there was very much great excitement, and the prefet had a luncheon for me. It was very hurriedly organized, but a very delicious luncheon. All the schools let out, and there were a jam of people around this place where we were having lunch. And the sergeant who drove the Marine Cadillac that I had, he was at the table with me. He and I were called out, and I was introduced by a very bombastic speech in French, which I couldn't... I said a bombastic speech, a very enthusiastic speech in French, which I couldn't understand, but very little of. And then I was introduced. And under the spur of the moment, under the pressure of the moment, I made a speech, which was received with tremendous cheers and great enthusiasm. And as far as we could figure out, there wasn't a verb in it. But it went all right. I would always amuse myself when I got involved in this affair there at Gondry. At this time, I've already forgotten the name of the place. But I might mention something about Doremi. I had to go by Doremi very frequently in my trips back and forth through this region, and of course it always appealed to me because of its historic significance. But what made quite an impression on me was there seemed to be so little change in the town. As far as I can see, it is the same old town it had always been. And Jean d'Arc's home didn't look like it had. It looked like just all the rest of them, not like it was something that had kept in repair through the years, and everything else was new in the village. There didn't seem to be anything new, and they all looked about alike. And while I was standing in the church next to Jean d'Arc's house and looking at this groined ceiling, I commented to my interpreter, whose name was Crocker. He was a well-known Crocker family up in Massachusetts, the paper mill people, and he had been at the... I started to say the Comédie Française, but I mean the Sorbonne, and was drafted as an interpreter. It was very good. Had him with me. And I asked him what he thought the age of that church was. And his reply was very significant to me. It conveyed years in a way I'd never heard before. He looked at it a long time. Well, he said, I think this church was built about as long before Jeanne d'Arc as we're living after Jeanne d'Arc. Well, that was one way to grasp it, because Jeanne d'Arc was in the dim and distant past to me, and I imagine to all the rest of us. This next part of 7 is a little bit out of place. It speaks of my bitterness in going through Beauvais, disappointed for me not giving duty to the troops. I was ordered away from the 1st Division just as I was going into the Soissons fight. And just after we got out of quite a fight in the Beauvais sector, as we called it, I think, south of Amiens and north of Beauvais, it seemed to be hopeless. There was very few graduates of the staff college, and they were all older than I was, and they were given divisions. But I wasn't given the division. I was jerked off to Europe. And before they organized these divisions, and when I was made acting chief of staff of the division, I was a captain, and the temporary promotions had started in the United States, but they hadn't reached to Europe. So that... I didn't get in on that, and these other fellows were made colonels and lieutenant colonels and chiefs of staff of division. I was still a captain, lingering over there with the 1st Division in France. Great opportunity to be with the division and get into its experiences, but it was developed into a great blockade of any promotion chances for me until I got this one Christmas, and then I found there was an order which prevented me from being promoted at all until the time of the Meuse-Argonne battle, and they changed the order. I couldn't have been promoted then, though I was being recommended by General Pershing to be a brigadier general. I think I went in on the first recommendation for general officers succeeding this from the St. Mel battle on into the Meuse-Argonne battle. They finally got out an order signed by the chief of staff at Chaumont that under no circumstances would I be detailed away from the general staff. Well, that was the final blow. They had me pinched then. I suffered all the way from lack of promotion in my early days. I had to do a great deal of work as an aide, because if I wasn't an aide, I was merely a lieutenant in the company. That lasted for pretty near 15 years. And I couldn't take up, they couldn't give me these things they wanted to because they didn't have the rank to take them. So I'd always have to operate in the general's name as a lieutenant. And then finally, when I became a captain, it was just when we started to begin the concentration for the First World War, and we moved on to Governor's Island. I think I got my captaincy at Governor's Island, I'm not certain. But it affected my entire career in getting started, because I was held back all the time and having to be an aide all the time, purely for the reason that the general could use my services as an aide by having me act in his name. I never was an aide as a young officer. You got a question 8 down here about General Pershing. I've told several things about General Pershing. I didn't say to him he was expecting too much of the man. I comment on the fact that he was ordering things from there in the evening that required a 20-mile march in the morning and some arrangement during the night, and some arrangements, none of which could be made. They were losing track of the distances entirely down Showmore, and we had no motors. I think I've told enough about this sort of thing of General Pershing at the present time. 9. I did not visit any of those fields in 44 and 45. I was not in a position to express myself about the Supreme Command and all that was concerned with it, and what powers the British government would have to resign to the French, and the same thing for our government. I knew General Pershing was for unity of command, but it's hard for me to tell when I knew it, because I heard so much of it afterwards. Of course, there was tardiness in deciding on a supreme commander. Only a disaster would have brought it to a head, and because the governments themselves had to give up too much. That's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, and it is only through the actions of Churchill that we were able to hit adjustments on everything at that time, and also the fact that so much was to be expected of America at the start in all of these early arguments that we have with the British staff officers, which you see now reflected in some of their books, where when we had virtually no army in trained existence, and they had all the troops. But of course that changed decidedly. So we had tremendous numbers of divisions, comparatively speaking. 79, I think, in all of ground divisions alone, and very large numbers of special troops and special brigades, artillery and tanks and engineers and things of that sort, and the Marines in addition, and terrific air force in numbers. None of that was available for argument or pressure or anything. It was all problematical, and nobody had ever dreamt of Patton being able to go over Europe at the rate he did, or of our troops to go through the line at Sampol the way they finally fought out in the First Army, and then virtually surrounded the Germans at the outbreak from the First European entry the Normandy beachhead. They later moves of the First Army, which was the initial army to move in, were very spectacular. But Patton was moving at such a rate, the attention went to him, and he himself, of course, was very dramatic, and that focused attention on him. But some of the First Army's performances there were magnificent, notably in making the avalanche gap for Patton to go through. That was made by the First Army. And then the counterattack that Hitler ordered himself, I forget the name of the Kantein or something like that, counterattack, which Bradley chose to, in a sense, ignore, to fight off while he was going ahead with his operations, which he did till they finally surrounded completely quite a section of the German army. And I think that's where General Eisenhower tells afterwards, was seeing a large area where you could step from body to body. All those things were done by the First Army, and then their eventual move out of the sector and wheel to the left, and final battles up on the Belgian border and into the Hindenburg Line. I might tell one thing about General Patton. South of Bar-le-Duc, I guess about 30 miles, was a small town called Gondricourt. That's where I first went to, and was this seat of division, first division schools, and the corps schools afterwards, officer schools. And I lived with a very interesting landlady. She was a very amusing woman, ran a wonderful mess for me, and I had three other fellows in it, one of which was Jean Hugo. And we had a very relaxing time in that mess. It saved me from the terrific strain we were going through in our other situations at that time. So Madame Zwart became very much endeared to me, and I to her, I think. I stayed there 6 months, and I had a little tiny room with a sort of a Napoleonic-looking bed, and she looked after me in every way she could. And when I left there, she kept in touch with me all the time, though I didn't see her again. And she wrote to me, first used to write to me each season, winter, summer, fall, and spring, and then she got so she'd write twice a year. Her boy had been a prisoner in the woods that I'd gone through with the Foreign Legion when recaptured it. And I brought some of the things back from that woods, machine guns and things, which I gave to her, and which she treasured very highly. Then this next war came, and of course she couldn't write to me after that, because she was in the occupied zone. And finally, Patton's troops drove through there and into the vicinity of Metz. So I sent him a message and told him if I thought Gondricourt was in his rear zone, that is, a zone he'd be responsible for, and if he got down there on one of his inspections, to look up my dear friend Madame Zouat, J-O-U-A-T-T-E, on 2 Rue Sorcy, S-O-R-C-Y. And the next I heard of it, he sent me the photographs and a description by a staff officer. Patton arrived there with 5,000 armored troops, 2 revolvers on, a whole truckload of supplies for Madame Zouat. The town turned out in fear and trembling. The mayor and the town council, whatever they call it, came to him trembling, and Patton growled at them in his best rough French, "Where is Madame Zouat?" Well, they'd never heard of Madame Zouat. And he turned over to her a whole truckload of supplies, enough to last her family a long, long time, and made quite an impression in Gondricourt of the importance of Madame Zouat. I came along while I was Secretary of State and was at the United Nations. And on one weekend, I went to Metz, went over the northernmost Meuse-Argonne battlefields, and came on down through Tours, T-O-U-R-S, and Gondricourt. I had my aide go ahead of me in another car, and find out if Madame Zouat was there, but not tell her that I was there. I was coming. And when I got there, he told me that she had moved, and she was at such a place in the main square of the town. I'll take a milkshake. So we drove there, and Mrs. Marshall didn't get out of the car, and I told her to stay in a second. I wanted to go up, surprise Madame Zouan. But the square was pretty full of people going to church. The church bells were ringing. It was a peaceful Sunday. But the fact of these two limousines there in the courtyard attracted all their attention. And when I got out of them, they all stopped and stared. And then Madame Zouat's curiosity had been aroused. She came out of her doorway in an old wrapper and in carpet slippers. And she wasn't a very dressy old lady anyway, and she looked pretty slack in these clothes. But she was unchanged otherwise. And she came out, and I'd crossed about half the distance when she looked up and recognized me. And she dashed at me and threw her arms around my neck and kissed me on both cheeks. So I embraced her and I kissed her, and we had a great scene out there with all the people in the square cheering. And then Ms. Marshall got out and came out, and we went into the house, and we'd gotten some things for her at Nancy, which Ms. Marshall gave to her, and a present of something, I've forgotten what, something like a waiter and a tray and things to go on. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, her excitement was intense, and it was a very joyful occasion, and I got great satisfaction out of it, and Mrs. Marshall particular satisfaction out of it. And as we were driving off, we had to hurry to get back to Paris. Mrs. Marshall began peeling out of her only fur coat. We'd gotten down the street about a block. I said, "What are you doing?" She says, "I'm going to give this to Madame Zouat." I said, "No, you're not. I haven't got enough money to buy you another one. You'll have to keep that." And I wouldn't let her give it to Madame Zouat. I was sorry afterwards I did it, but the fact was I didn't have enough money to do that. I went through the war when my responsibilities ran up to 8.5, almost 10 million troops, and 9 fighting sectors. My salary was $10,000 a year, and I spent all my savings, and that didn't meet my bills, and I had a very, very hard time. All the time I was chief of staff, and then when I was secretary of state, all I got was $15,000 a year. Now, cut her off a minute. You want the background of the decision on the San Miguel fight? Well, it was